Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another edition of the Mundane Festival Podcast. I'm your host, Chris Lamberth. Today is Sunday, May 27th, 2018. Remember, as always, you can subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and on Podbean, the host site. If you like this show, please rate and review it on Apple Podcasts and or Stitcher. Give it a 5-star review. Let everyone know why you like it, because it will make me feel good about myself and most of the life decisions that I've made so far. You can email the show at mundanefestivalpod@gmail.com. Let me know what's on your mind. More importantly, what's on your heart. You can like the show on Facebook. You can follow it on Twitter at Mundane Festival. And you can follow me, your host, the guy talking to you right now on Twitter at Chris Lamberth. This is episode 288. I have a very special guest, comedian, actor, playwright Jordan Temple is on the show this week. Super excited to share this conversation with you. I'm going to do that in a bit. Right now, I'm just going to start by wishing you all a happy Memorial Day weekend. I hope you got the 3 days off. I hope some of you were able to take that Friday off, you know, and get the weekend started a little earlier. And I hope everybody has a safe and happy one. I hope that you're eating your burgers and hot dogs and just having a fucking blast, bro. But I hope you're doing it safe. You know, I hope this is one of those times where people, you know, the sun is out. We're actually it's kind of raining today, but anyway, I just hope everybody, when the summertime people start to go crazy and all that shit, but just be safe, everybody. And have a great time and enjoy yourself. I thought this weekend was going to be me. And this is like when the weekends are crazy like this, like a holiday weekend, that's usually the time where I like to go see my parents or just be reclusive in my apartment. And, comedy has called me and I've been, doing some shows hosting at Levity Live. I've been emceeing for Taylor Tomlinson, LA comic, and it's been fun. Like, it's me, it's Taylor, Paul Spratt, and myself. Paul's been featuring, and it's been fun. Like, they're cool as shit to hang out with and talk to. These crowds have not been that good. The first crowd, the Thursday night crowd, was fun. It was like a medium-sized crowd, small but mighty, but they were fucking fun, and we had a great time. Friday, first show was like, eh. Second show was blech. They were drunk. The late show, people were sauce because they had been drinking probably since they got off work at 4 or 5 o'clock. And then Saturday, these last two shows were just kind of, ugh. The first show was fine. The second show was just, so we got one more tonight. And this is like, this weekend has sort of been like a role-playing game weekend where I talk about, like, I've said it before in the show, where it's like comedy's like an RPG where you level up. And this is where you kind of had to slog it out and really try to figure yourself out and just hack it out with the crowds. I didn't kirk out on them or anything. I think I kind of told one crowd to kind of stop talking. And because I'm a big black dude, it's sort of like I become the vice principal. I always say that shit when you have to correct somebody or just like set the rules. Because like Paul, Taylor, and I were talking about, like, sometimes, like, every time, one thing about a club, I don't know if this is the same for all comedy clubs that are in a mall, you don't know if they're real comedy fans, where they're coming because of the headliner. Some, like, they come because the headliner's famous. Taylor is like about to blow up. Like, she was on Last Comic Standing. She was on Conan. She's got a Netflix special coming out in a month, in about a little over a month. And so she's on the rise, but it's going to be like, you know, like, and then maybe in another year, people will be like, oh shit, Taylor Thompson, you know, but like they don't know who they're coming to see, and you have to kind of train them to do the show as a host. Like it, the job is really hard sometimes, you guys. It is one of the hardest jobs, and I find a sense of pride that I get asked to do it, even though like the feature spot is easier. Like in headlining, you get to do more time, you get to do, you know, whatever you want and all that shit, and it's fucking awesome. That's what you want to be, but I'm not a draw. I'm being honest with myself. I'm not a draw. Can I headline and put on a good show? Of course. But in the scheme of things, like it's still cool that people think that you can do that, believe that you can do the job and you do it well. But this one was, and I find a sense of pride in that. But it's like you just don't want to get pigeonholed. Oh, you're a good host and nothing else. But I've proven myself to be a strong feature and a strong headliner. So let me get out of my own bullshit and just get to what we're talking about. Hosting was just like with this weekend. It's been like a fucking role playing game where I definitely had to hack it out and try to open this show up. And you got to train the people because it's like you're in a mall. And it's a beautiful theater, but a lot of these people, they could have went anywhere. They could have went to Dave and Buster's. They could have went to TGI Fridays. But you can't, like, you got to tell them, like, yo, you're not at TGI Fridays. You chose to come to a comedy club, and there's people talking in front of you trying to entertain you, so you shouldn't fucking be talking. And you try to do that as nicely as possible. And you try to, you know, do what you got to do. But yeah, and I felt good about a couple of the shows where it was like, yeah, I got them open. I got them ready for some comedy. And it was cool. So it goes, man. Sometimes you got to really work for that bread, young. I'm happy to have to do this weekend, get a little extra change, got my car fixed. I got the air conditioner fixed in my car, young. And my God, like, you know, and I could tell the difference. Like, my AC was working. A couple weeks ago, I went to get my oil changed. And, you know, they always try to diagnose your shit and say your car has cancer and sickle cell and all this shit. And you're like, man, you don't have the money. But then it's like, I was like, okay, in a couple weeks, I'm going to get it done. I'm going to get it taken care of. And so I was like, all right, I'm going to get it done. And they did like a AC flush and a recharge of the Freon. You gearheads, if you're listening, you know what I'm talking about. And oh, my God, it was so much better. Like, you didn't get the weird smell sometimes when it comes from the outside fumes and all that shit. And it was so much better. It was much colder. I felt like I was in an igloo, and I felt like it was good. So I was really glad to get that done. I bought two games, and I normally just buy like one or two games a year. And, cause I was eyeing Detroit Become Human. I wanted to play that game for the longest time. And that was like, ever since I heard about it, maybe it was 2 years ago, but it was at least a year or more that I was anticipating this game. And so I saved some money aside to get, like, I paid some of my bills up, and I was like, okay, I'm gonna just get this game, and I'm just gonna do it. But then when I was talking to my nerd video game friends about this shit, everybody's like, oh, you got to play God of War. You got to play God of War. It's the best game ever. It's better than The Last of Us. I'm like, what the fuck? It's better than are you serious? Are you serious right now? You're going to say it's better than The Last of Us? So Brian McGinnis was saying that shit. I'm calling them out. Mike Brown was saying it. And I'm like, yo, man, Mike, we talked for, the first time Mike did the show, we talked for like an hour, at least an hour, about The Last of Us. And how great it is and how compelling it is. And you're just going to just say that this game is just not, that God of War is better. And he's been telling me about it. He's been I said, well, I'm getting Detroit Become Human. I'm excited about it. He's like, nah, man, you need to da-da-da-da-da. And I'm like, yo, man, like I can see that it's an excellent game. I've watched reviews. I watched this one review like Thursday afternoon on my lunch break where this guy from Australia was talking about like, oh my god, it's the best game ever. I got a shitty Australian accent. It's the best game ever. It's amazing. And he was saying, so he shitted on some of my favorite games. He said, it's better than The Last of Us. You don't have to move letters all the time. Like, he was like talking about, we just moving ladders in The Last of Us. Is that what you're reducing the game to? Like, he was being really reductive, and I was pissed. And then he shit on Horizon Zero Dawn. He was like, yeah, it's an open world game. And it's just open world to say it's open world. I'm like, well, that's what it's billed as. It's billed as an open world game. So what are we doing here? You're shitting on two of the best games to ever be released for the platform, for PlayStation 4. And then he shat on Uncharted. He didn't really shit on it, but he said it was better than all three of those games. And I was just like, and obviously I'm... You know, there were five technically Uncharted games, but I was like, damn. I was like, well, fuck. It's better than all of those games. And he didn't really show any clips. He was like, I'm not going to spoil it for you because to spoil it would be to ruin the game. And I'm just telling you how dope this game is, how great it is. And then it kind of put this in. And then I thought about this. I think this guy might have like put it into perspective for me, because he was saying, I don't know if he said it or somebody else said it, but if you say like The Last of Us is, to me, it's the greatest game I ever played in my life right now. And it's going to be hard for me to really come off that. But he said the best game that was made for PS3 was The Last of Us. For that generation, it was the best game. And then he said, and like, because that kind of closed the loop on PlayStation 3, and that's what it was, PS3. You capped it out with The Last of Us. So he said the same way that was for PS3, God of War is that for PS4, because PlayStation 5 is coming out soon. And I was like, okay, I could be a little more at peace with that. So I was like, okay, all right. And so then I'm hosting the shows at Levity Thursday night, hosting the first show. And I just like scoot out, just take a little break and go across the mall, across the way to the GameStop. And I'm in GameStop and I'm talking to the guys that were working there. I'm talking to the sales clerks and whatnot. And they were like, God of War is the best game ever made. It's the best game ever for PlayStation. It's like, and the guy looked at my beard and he said, yeah, looking at your beard's going to be down to your knees by the time you finish playing it, and blah, 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 and talking about all this. And he's like, well, do you guys have a used copy? Because I knew I was getting Detroit the next day. But then GameStop, their used copy, if they're selling the game for $59 and $64 plus tax, like the shit's, they're gonna probably gonna make it 50. I was like, fuck it. They didn't have it. So I was like, okay, just give me the game. And then the next day I bought Detroit Become Human. And let's sidebar, Detroit Become Human is a good game. Like people were shitting on like they don't like interactive games, I guess. A lot of people don't like it, but I don't see why you can't exist where you can't just like, oh my God, I like Detroit Become Human, I like God of War. I feel like I can like both these games at the same time. And I don't know IGN gave it an 8. God of War is a masterpiece. They gave it a 10. Metacritic Detroit Become Human. Let's see. 79%. So they gave it a 79. God of War. But it's two different games. Of War, Metacritic. Let's see, 94. So let's get to Detroit. Let me talk about, I'm blabbing like shit on this, but you're just getting a robust holiday edition of the show where I'm nerding out about fucking video games. Damn, last week I'm really blowing the facade of me not being a nerd, where I call other people nerds, and then I'm talking about fucking Infinity War for 20 minutes, and now I'm talking about video games. But I don't talk about video games that much, so I'm gonna try to get a Patreon edition of me talking to Brian McGinnis or Mike Brown. Brian McGinnis, very funny comic. He's a part of the Playable Characters podcast. You can get it everywhere you listen to podcasts, where they have mainly comedians and actors come on the show and portray different video game characters, and it's really funny. He does it with two other comics, Alok Patel, who's been on the show, and very funny dude, Calvin Cato. So they do that. So you should check that podcast out. JL's been on the show a couple times. The funniest shit I've heard on a podcast in recent memory was JL playing he played an NBA Jam announcer or something, a WNBA Jam. It's funny, man. Look, check out that podcast. It's really funny. So there's that. And I'm scheduled to make an appearance on that show too. They've been asking me to do it, and I finally said yes, and I'm going to have something fun for them. But anyway, all right. So if you've listened to this show long enough, you've known that I'm a really big fan of Beyond Two Souls. I really liked it. Beyond Two Souls was the Ellen Page, Willem Dafoe game, and Kadeem Hardison, and I just love that game. And it's fun because it's like, it's actors and it's interactive and shit. And it's, yeah, sometimes the controls can be kind of clunky, but it's made from the same company that made Heavy Rain and now Detroit Become Human, and the company is Quantic Dream. And so that's kind of their style. That's kind of what they're into, and with this game. And I may have played for about 2.5-3 hours at best of the game, and I like it. It's fun. Like, it's got Jesse L. Williams playing this an android. Let me do the. I'll read you the blurb on this. Okay, inspired by the short story called Kara, Detroit is a neo-noir thriller set in the near future city of Detroit. Androids who look exactly like human beings have replaced humans in most tasks. They are workers, babysitters, gardeners, nurses, teachers, clerks. The story of Detroit starts with an unexplained incident that begins to affect the androids. Some appear without any explanation. Others have unexpected behaviors and strangely show signs of emotions. The rumors of deviant androids, that's in quotes, start spreading, but no one seems to know what's really happening. And that's basically what this game is. And it's in the near future. It's like 2038 in Detroit. And you control three different androids. One is this highly evolved android, this android who is named Connor, who is used for detective purposes and analyzing crime scenes and all this stuff. And you're taking control over him for part of the journey. You take him through a story. He has a storyline. There is a character named Marcus that's played by Jesse L. Williams. And I'm gonna get back to that in a second. And he's like the android that's about to start a revolution for the androids. And he's the one. Well, okay. So this is where I think Fontaine and I were talking about this, where it's like, you know, a game. Yeah, because this was like late 2016, mid to late 2016. And he and I were talking about it when he was on a couple years ago, where I was like, you know, a game is going to be lit when you have an black android robot singing a Negro spiritual. Like, he's like, hold on a little while longer. Hold on a little while longer. Like, he's singing some shit like that. And you're like, this shit is about to be amazing. And so, and actually, and also, this is the game, I think, to get a little bossipy about on this podcast. Jesse L. Williams, his co-star was Minka Kelly, and I think this is where they met, and there might have been some infidelity shit going on, and led to Jesse L. Williams being on the extra features of Jay-Z's 444, talking about relationships and shit. And because his android falls in love with hers, I believe. I haven't gotten to that part yet, but it's kind of like, kind of gets a little awkward when you, anyway. And then you play this woman, you play an android named Kara, who the story kind of revolves around, as far as like the kernel that made this video game, because they did a short about it. And she's this android that is basically a domesticated android that takes care of a little girl and an abusive dad. And what's interesting about this is that when you play Kara, you start out being in the store, and this abusive guy comes in because he's gotten you fixed, and you find out why you got fixed, why Kara gets fixed, because she was broken before, and you find out how she got broken, and basically shit gets out of hand, and you have to take care of some shit. You can choose. It's basically, you can choose your own adventure, and it's a linear story, but there's different ways that things could end up. Like, your android could get killed, and the story can get changed and shit. So it's really fun. It's like an interactive movie, and I really dig it. I'm enjoying it so far. I don't mind games like these. I don't mind them at all. It's really fun, and there's a really intense scene in this Kara episode where basically the fucking dad is doing drugs. I think he's huffing something, or he's doing coke, and he gets mad at the kid because the mother left with an accountant or some shit, and the little girl runs upstairs, and it's like this moment where you kind of become, for lack of a better term, woke, and you have to like break through, and you have to protect this little girl, and it's really intense. And when I saw these previews, my thing was, I'm saving that little girl. And some fucking pretentious asshole was like, oh, the little girl's not cute enough, or she just doesn't look like you want to save her or whatever. I'm like, you fucking asshole. Like, you know, and I don't know, man. Like, so both, shout out to Brian McGinnis and Mike Brown, they both sent me people who reviewed the game and didn't like it. Like, Polygon didn't like it. Mike sent me one yesterday. Polygon was like, oh, it's blah, 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 blah. And then and then Brian sent me the day that the embargo, that Friday. No, Thursday he sent me one where somebody didn't like it. But it's a 79, man. It's 79 on Metacritic, and IGN liked it. I like it. And if you're interested, I think Beyond Two Souls is free on PlayStation Plus. I had it on PS3, but I believe it's free on PlayStation Plus. So I really like it. I dig it. That's my review for for Detroit Become Human. So I was like, okay, all these people. And then I'm doing the show Friday night. And so I bought Beyond Two Souls or whatnot, and doing the show Friday, and some of the guys on a couple of the servers and me are talking about video games and shit, and they're talking about God of War, and the director was like talking about how he was just so moved because it took him 5 years to make the game. He had a YouTube video of him like reacting to towards all the good reviews, and he was crying, and I was like, fuck, man, I gotta play this game. So I was like, I'm gonna give it. And I, you know, and I believe people that said this game was good, and I was like, okay, I'm gonna play it. And so yesterday I was like, I'm giving it an hour just to say that I've played it, and just to just kind of get into what's good, what's really good with this game. And holy shit, it's good. You start off as Kratos, and I haven't played God of War since maybe PS3, where it's normally just like you're it's a button masher where you're just like, you know, slamming your finger on these buttons and killing all these creatures and shit. And this game has that, but you start this game off, you have to cremate your wife. You chop down the tree with your axe, and then you pick up the tree and you take it to your house, and then you use it to cremate your wife at the beginning of the fucking game. So basically the mission is to get your wife's ashes to a mountain, and you spread the ashes with your kid, and then the kid is like your ally, and he helps you out. And already I can tell how dope this is, because the kid is Atreus is like it's a different type of AI. And I remember like listening to the director, watching the director in YouTube videos talk about, and in one YouTube video talking about how he was like, I don't know if we can do this with this AI. We've looked at, like, and see, the cool thing about this guy, director, I'm gonna get his name, director of, his last name is Balrog, God of War, Corey Barlog. And he's talking about how, yeah, I don't know, should we scrap the kid? Should we just get rid of him? And they were just trying to figure out how to do this. And he did reference The Last of Us as, like, you know, using Ellie. But it's just totally different, and it's really cool. And I can see already where you're just fighting this big-ass ogre of a monster. And it was just, like, it was really cool. The camera work, I'm still trying to get used to it, and it's interesting because it's all in one shot, and I've only played for a little over an hour, but I'm enjoying it. It is fun, and I'm interested in seeing where that journey takes me. But I'm just going to say, this God of War is dope. Like, everybody that says it's dope, they're right. But I'm saying this right now, Young. I'm saying this right now, and I've said it before. Neil Druckmann is just chilling on y'all. I don't know what's going to happen with this E3. I don't know. You know, that trailer that came out last year was dope. It was incredible. I don't know what's going to happen with E3. But Neil Druckmann, he's been giving everybody props. He was like, when Horizon Zero Dawn came out, he was like, yo, the Guerrilla Games, yo, y'all killed it. He interviewed. And I think all these guys are friends. All these people that make these games, it's a community, like comedians and shit, like anything. Like, it's a fraternity, you know, and women too. You know, that's just a term. I'm not trying to exclude anybody. But it's a society. And then everybody, you know, they all fuck with each other for the most part. So it seems. And he was talking to the creator about Horizon Zero Dawn and whatnot. And he's like, yo, this game is great. It's amazing. Blah, blah, blah. You guys have revolutionized this IP is fantastic. And he's been giving everybody props. When this Last of Us Part 2 comes out, I feel like he's got this trump card. I feel like he's got this joker he's just going to put out on that table and be like, look, man, I'm reclaiming this GOAT status. Like, y'all can party right now, but when this Last of Us Part 2 comes out, yo. So, yeah, that's me. That's the end of me nerding out about these video games. But I'm excited to. I'm just really. And then Tomb Raider's coming out. The new Tomb Raider's coming out in September. Spider-Man's coming out. A couple other games that I would be interested in, but just not like right away. But this is enough. This I'm excited about those. Let's get to Jordan. I've talked enough. This is basically like two episodes in one. Jordan Temple is a terrific comic. You've probably seen him on Conan, and he created this play called Hidden Fences, and it's going to be in, you can see it if you're in LA. You can see it on June 7th and June 8th at Dynasty Typewriter at the Hayworth, 2511 Wilshire Boulevard in Los Angeles, California. So make sure you follow Jordan Temple on social media. And if you're in LA, go see the show. Just a really funny dude. I've just known of him for quite some time. Been Facebook friends with him, been friendly with him in passing, and just always enjoyed the guy's stand up and wanted to have him on the show. And we talk about some shit. And I really, really like talking to him because, you know, we didn't go into full in depth really about talking about writing for TV and film, but we just kind of, I feel like we kind of just got the tip of the iceberg for TV, like writing for TV, but more specifically writing for episodic TV and writing for late night TV, which is really cool. And you know, black writers, young, you know what I'm saying? So it was really cool to sit down and talk to him. And I had a great time. And here's me, without further ado, talking to the very funny Jordan Temple. Enjoy.
So how long have you lived here? You're from Queens, right?
Yeah, I'm born and raised in Queens. Yeah.
So you're, I think you might, no, you're not. Mike Brown is a New York native. I was trying to think about. And
it's me, Pearlman, Nico, Gary Cottett,
Damian
Sydney,
Lynn.
And Marie, I think.
Okay.
Both of them, yeah, Sydney and Marie. And Che. And
yeah.
That's it, I think.
So all your dreams kept you here.
Yeah, I guess. Oh, and my buddy, fucking seen him forever. I can't see his face, not his name.
Is he really your friend, Jordan?
Yeah.
What's that guy?
Drew Dowdy.
That's my buddy. Oh, yeah.
Is
he still doing stand-up?
I think he's back and forth, but whenever people talk about Native New Yorkers, especially, always think about Drew because he had a really good quote one time about, like, he was like, you know, some people, a lot of people move to New York to realize their dreams,
mm-hmm.
but for like Native New Yorkers to realize their dreams, we just had to go outside, you know?
Yeah.
And like, yeah, that's kind of how I feel like growing up in New Yorkers, especially. It's super hard to live here, and you kind of have to like realize that you're living in hell, you know what I mean? Mm. Like, but know how to make of it what you will, because you knew it's bad in the first place. Some people look at it from the outside in with rose colored glasses, and sure. You're completely, you know, unmoved by it, and like, you know, kind of over it, disillusioned by the time you realize, you know,
mm-hmm.
what it actually is, especially like growing up not with any money, you know, mm-hmm. especially growing up poor like I did. I, you know, I lived not too far from here. I was, you know, up until like 2 years ago in projects with my mom. So it was like, I didn't know what I was doing for the longest, you know. I just, and, you know, I have a much better sense now, but growing up in New York is abysmal. It's terrible. I don't plan on having kids, but I think it's definitely not the best place to raise them. Yeah, New York City is just, it's brutal.
So you're not gonna be one of those New York ambassadors when they're like, come to New York.
No, move away, get out of here.
Yeah,
I have to leave to come back to actually appreciate it because, it's just. I mean, we had winter for 9 whole months.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, you know, it's just all the basic things, you know, you hear about it is garbage, especially I think what a lot of other people I feel like from other cities don't realize is like they'll grow up poor and like move here and they'll be like, well, it's like some a lot of aspects of it aren't that bad because they don't see a lot of it right in their face. Like I think some of the poverty, but like I think the centralized poverty here is all project buildings, like, and it's not houses. Like there's a lot of houses. People have houses and they're poor living in houses in other states. Right. And you come to New York and it's 20-foot buildings on the 6-block radius, and I think that's worse.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because, you know, not only is this city, like, you know, in terms of volume and number of people, like a bunch of cities in one, but that means there's way more poor people. And it's just, you know, us, like, just stacked on top of each other and just all put in the box. I'm just very optimistic. I don't know if you can.
No, hear. Keep that shit real. Man. Like I want the real. You know what I'm saying? Like it. Because every
depressing.
When I came,
can't wait to live.
Leave. You can't. Leave. Can't wait to leave.
Yeah, can't wait to leave. I'm dying to live. Where are you from?
I'm originally from Maryland, right outside of DC.
DMV. Okay.
So I'm like suburban. You know, like this is, and I live in Jersey, so it's like. I can follow my dreams, and then I can leave.
At a safe distance.
Yeah. Like, because when I lived in Chicago for 5 years, my listeners know this, but I did some...
What up, listeners?
Yeah, well, trained and did theater and stuff out there, and when I was looking for a place, I was like, I can't, this is expensive.
Right.
And it doesn't seem like it's that great for how much money they want you to put down.
Absolutely.
So I eventually stayed with some friends when I moved here in like Nyack, like so like in Rockland County, which is like less than an hour outside of the city.
Uh-huh.
And then I was looking for places like Queens and ended up in Hackensack because some of my coworkers lived there. And I was like, okay, it's not that far from the job. Cool. And I've just been there ever since. And so when I started doing stand up here, it was just like, navigating the city, figuring out where stuff was, and then driving everywhere, and then just getting the lay of the land, and then just like, you know, it's. I've noticed like Astoria, Long Island City, how much has changed in the last 10 years, where it's like, oh, you can easily get a parking space now. Mm-hmm. All these restaurants are popping up, all the hipsters are. Well, rich people are moving into Long Island City.
Yeah, and they're moving in those pockets of like Long Island City closest to like Manhattan. It's like literally like 5 minutes, 5-10 minutes from Manhattan, or like right across is like a body of water, and then like East River, and then you can see that shit right there, like all the city and the skyline, and that's a lot of the appeal, I guess. You know?
Yeah, because I know a lot of comics live here. And
yeah, a bunch in Astoria.
Yeah, and in Brooklyn, where it's like, but it seems like even these areas are starting to get like overpopulated with the rich people moving in because they don't have any more space in the city, or there's no more space in Brooklyn, and even parts in Jersey, people are moving into like Montclair.
Oh yeah,
it's just like damn, like
Montclair used to be, even though it's like fancy in some pockets, there's still pockets of like. Reasonably
hood
priced or even hood. Or even hood areas.
Yeah.
Because East Orange is like right there.
Mm-hmm.
Like all you know, all Orange. East and South. But yeah, there are definitely some parts. I used to live in Union.
Okay. Yeah.
Used to live in Union.
Yeah, Gordon Baker Bone used to have a I guess you could say that's Union County.
Was that Newark? No?
He lives in. He used to have a show at Hell's Kitchen. Justin Williams has a show in Newark, but he used to have his place like that was in the burbs. Called.
Shout out to these comedians.
Yeah,
the listeners definitely know.
Yeah, they know. They'll know. Like, oh, if they listen.
It's Jersey people.
It's all like they know. Like they know Gordon.
Hell yeah!
And they'll know
Shout
you.
Out to Gordon.
Yeah, they'll know you now.
Shout out to Gordon and Justin Williams.
Yeah, black actors.
Black actors. We got us together.
Yeah, man.
So you're waiting to get, and you've gotten out kind of, right? When you're writing for, you wrote for Smilf.
Yeah, I wrote for Smilf.
That was a good show. What was that like?
Yeah, it was cool. It was very quick. You know, people say like in comedy, like you wait, and then it happens all at once.
Yeah.
Or something. So like, that's what happened to me. I did at my first interview for it with the creator, because she had seen my
Frankie,
my sample, Frankie Shaw. She's seen Hidden Fences, and she
talk
saw,
about that a bit.
She saw my stand up and stuff, and the stand up was in the voice of the show. Mm-hmm. She really liked it. And then the day after I did my fourth staging of my play Hidden Fences, mm-hmm. I had the second interview with her, and then the third interview with the EPs, and I got the job, and I had to move in a day to LA because the job started on Monday. It was a real whirlwind, but yeah.
Can you go back a little bit and just talk about the origins of Hidden Fences, and tell the people what was it about?
For sure.
I know, but you know.
Well, Hidden Fences is it originated with the Jenna Bush debacle, that mistake.
Mm-hmm.
Was
it 2016 Oscars?
Yeah,
2017. Last January.
And then, well, again, at the Golden Globes with Michael Keaton? Everyone's talking about Hidden Fences, about the viral mistake, you know, they made at both not being able to differentiate two black movies. And then I woke up one day, while everyone was making jokes on Twitter and stuff, I was thinking, like, how can I, like, galvanize on something, make it, like, a more long-form idea? And then Hidden Fences just came to me to, like, make something long-form, a play. So I made a play out of the mistake. It was kind of like a send-up of, In Living Color and, a lot of like black comedy references, art, culture. I kind of mixed them.
Sure.
Kind of made like a fun like mashup show that encapsulated, a lot of shit that's going on with the culture. Made it funny, of course, first and foremost, and then it took off. It had a life of its own. I did the first staging on February 24th, and then on the 25th they made the gaffe again a second time, and then the day after, coincidentally, I had scheduled Hidden Fences a second time. Mm-hmm. So my performance was bookended by the mistake, and then it gave it more life and more exposure into the third performance, which I had like 300 people. And then after that, I had the fourth one in June. And then, I went to L.A., and then I came back, did that job, and then I got another job in between.
Is it The Rundown?
The Rundown.
Well, talk a little bit about writing for, like, the difference between writing for an episodic as opposed to, like, a late-night talk show.
Well, I was glad that I got to write for scripted first, because mm-hmm. it's much harder to go from late night to scripted and it is to go from scripted to late night, because of I just think the amount of like access there are in like both a little bit, like there's more scripted, there's less late night, but late night for some reason is given a certain connotation, like people don't give you the benefit of the doubt as if you can write for a scripted show after you've written for a late night.
Okay.
And it's much easier to just keep on doing late night because it's such a formatted thing. At least that's my own understanding. I could be completely wrong, but...
Well, it's just based on your experience, man.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, well, I mean, I... was waiting to get a you know, call back or whatever for the rundown, but I got a job in scripted first, mm-hmm. and then I interviewed while I actually had the job for Smoke for the rundown. So you know, it's a lot of difficulties in both, I think, because in scripted it's like you can kind of blue sky and be like, well, we're going to see what's going to happen with this character, or what's the B story here, or, you know, it's not like constant joke pitching. Like it's using the appropriate joke given the character's like
situation
or experience. It's sometimes situational, but also like personal stories and anecdotes and narratives help add to and fill out wherever the scene is going, or wherever that character's motivation or whatever could go. But in Late Night, it is all based on what Trump tweeted that day. Mm-hmm. And that is why I really don't like Late Night and prefer it. I'm looking forward to, you know, Conan eventually, you know, he does his like Anthony Bourdain kind of, you know, remotes where he goes to other countries. And mm-hmm. now that he's only doing half hours a week, you know, I'm looking forward to in like 5 years when he's exclusively on Netflix. And of course, he's not doing Late Night anymore, but he's doing his own travel thing where he has comedy.
So he's leaving?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, he's going to a half hour formatted thing, but one of the only voices I really enjoy in Late Night right now is one that is completely minimized because he doesn't talk about Trump like that. Mm-hmm. And Conan is just one of those people who is just pure funny first. He's the funniest person in Late Night, and he just doesn't get the love.
I've always liked him the most, like even when I was growing up, because he was just like the self-deprecating guy. Yeah, he was funny. He wasn't
funny, weird.
Vulnerability.
He's like, yeah.
And I always liked how he would hit on women, even though it was playfully. I know in the Me Too era,
yeah, right.
But you can't really. It's he would funny, be like, like if like, I don't know, goofy. Kim Basinger was on interview, he's like, oh,
no one
like,
takes it serious.
Yeah. It's fun.
Yeah, definitely. But yeah, I love Conan for that reason. I feel like his voice has been minimized, but it's also he is thinking ahead of the medium because he's the only person who does those remotes. I think that is kind of where the future is, at least in my mind. That's the comedy I like. But I think when Trump is no longer president, Late Night is going to have to figure some shit out.
What the fuck we're going to do.
Yeah. I think they're really going to have to figure it out. And I think the only reason why there are so many more Late Night shows is because Trump is president. And I think when he's no longer president, it will be nice to see, you know, where Conan goes, because he already has to be more futuristic in the sense of his format, his content, and his jokes, you know? It's
right.
Not always Trump, 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 Trump.
Like, yeah, because a lot of people have kind of blown up. Like,
it's exhausting. Even,
like, where it's been like, oh, this person, like, I think maybe it was Colbert. Like, he was kind of slumping. And then when he took shots at Trump, he started to, you know, even though I like him, but.
Sure.
I late night stuff, I watch it on YouTube. And I watch if, like, you're on there. I watch, like, if people I know are doing sets on late night, I'll watch that. Right. But otherwise, it's that and then Clueless Gamer, which Conan does.
Oh, word.
Yeah, he does, like, what did he do with that? He had Bill Hader on, and they played God of War for PS4.
Oh,
PS4,
dope.
And, like, you know, like crack jokes and shit like that.
That's dope.
Yeah. So, would you go back? Are you going back to Smilf, or?
No, they already have the season 2 room. They only brought back one writer from season 1.
Were you the only black guy in there?
Yeah. I was only black on both sides black. And there was an older woman, she was mixed, but...
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
What was that? Would they be like, Jordan, what do you think about this?
For sure.
Yeah.
It's a fine line, I think, especially being like a black writer, specifically a black male writer in late night, because I feel like the voices in in writer's room are less, are skewing more like white male, like being on the opposite of that, being like a black dude, especially like there's opportunities for us to like, I think, break in if like we can like agree on certain things, on, you know, or if like with white dudes, or if like they just think our shit is funny, but there's a very slim margin for that, because it's like, it's sadly people only think of black people in terms of who's the hottest out right now. So if it all depends on how far or how close they think you are to that, and if it doesn't match up with what they have in their mind, then you have to either like kind of will yourself there, or kind of, you know, be like pushed a little bit to the margins, because they, you know, sadly, even though we have shows like Blackish and, you know, Rel shows got picked up, and, you know, Lena Waithe's 20s is coming out, we have Insecure in Atlanta, sadly they still, Hollywood still thinks, you know, black people are a monolith and they don't really like that much variation. So they look at what's hot and they try to duplicate that, male and female, and especially black women, because, you know, with Tiffany Haddish's success, they just want a bunch of mini Tiffany Haddishes.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? They want a bunch of black women who are like characters of what is hot. You know what I mean? So,
like very reasonable facsimiles.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's unfortunate. But yeah, did I answer that?
You did. And but I wanted to know like what it's
meandering
like.
Meandering ass nigga.
Man. Oh, what's that?
Meandering ass nigga.
No, that's it's a podcast.
I know.
You're fine.
Fun.
You know what you're talking about, because I guess you know, like being on a TV show, like writing for an episodic, and you being the only black guy, like how, what's that like?
Oh, fuck. Lonely as shit. Nah.
No, just
nah, we have fun.
Because I never, like, I never get to really, you know, kind of get, like, open up the hood on somebody, like a black dude or anybody really that writes for television and won a show that just kind of, that first season was really good. Like, it's a good show. Because when I saw that you were writing on there, I watched the pilot before I knew that you wrote on there, and then I think you posted about it on Facebook. I was like, "Oh, that's a good show." So like,
right.
Like, because it's a show that has like a lot of prestige attached to it now,
right? With Rosie and yeah, I don't know, what is it like? I don't know. It was a lot of firsts for me, and also given my own. Even though I'd like to leave out descriptors or, you know, qualifiers, but given what I am, my experience is super narrow as compared to what the vision of the show is. So, like, I'm black. I have a single mom, from a single mom. So, like, it's about a single mom.
Right.
S is literally the first thing. I could speak on that. But I was also the only stand-up in the room and the only black person in the room, and that was hard, because one of the things that made me feel, and just in terms of my sense of humor, because it is a comedy, that made me feel the most isolated was that I was a stand-up. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And getting out that point of view and challenging it, and also settling with and exploring other people's point of views, and then adjusting my own like strengths to strengthen that of the show, while also balancing what the room needed and knowing that I was a complete newbie, also being a qualifier, was a real and true balancing act. And it was difficult to get the job. It was much harder to be at the job every day, to contribute, to feel like I belong, to feel like I was a part of the show, mm-hmm. while also really just learning how a show was made in the first place.
Yeah.
Because it's a lot of like note taking, a lot of breaking story, and just some honestly like quiet moments, just like very much not filling sometimes, you know, dead air with speech, which I feel like is something Atlanta does a good job of not doing. Now I realize that, you know, just because, you know, I'm not saying anything doesn't mean I'm not thinking or trying to problem solve. And I think for that room, especially in it, for it being my first experience and just like living in a lot of that discomfort of all those first and all those qualifiers is was something I, you know, I settled with by just knowing that it's okay to not speak when you don't have anything really to say. you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Sometimes you're so pressured, and you can hear it when people speak sometimes. They're just speak even like more, mm-hmm. and like nothing is coming out. And I think in my own, like, what I want to make of my career, what the things that I want to put on the big and small screen, and just in general, just like even talking to you, talking to my friends and family, my loved ones, is just like taking more time and being more thoughtful with the words that I speak. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Like, yeah.
Words I speak and words I write.
I think you're absolutely right. Especially in this day and age, like what we do as comics, it's just like, well, I'm saying this, and it's gonna, the goal is to make people laugh, but how the way that I'm saying it, how is it going to affect people? Even though at the same time, once it leaves your mouth, it's no longer yours to a certain degree.
And so it's just an interpretation.
Right. And it's just like, how do you grapple? And I think that's the fun in it all, but it's like, still, it's just kind of like, there's a weight to what you say. How am I going to affect? Because I have this thing where I've been writing about like interracial dating, mm-hmm. not to just like just the anxiety that comes with it that I feel. Mm-hmm. And it's like, the way that I say it, like, how is that? Is that gonna, it's my experience, so it is what it is, but it's just like, well, what's the message, what's the underlying theme, what's going on, how am I presenting it, how am I setting it up? But that's with every bit, but there's mm-hmm. a sensitivity that's attached to it too. And I remember like working that chunk like at Caroline's, and it was like, there were like black women there, and one of my friends was like, you just gotta be honest, you have to say what you have to say. And like they respected me for what it was. But I just think like, fuck, I don't even know what I'm saying here. It's just something that's just like a bit that I'm working on and trying to refine it, because I want to do an album this year. Mm-hmm. And it's just like, I don't know. I don't even know where the fuck I'm going with that. I think it's just covering all your bases, but at the same time trying to be funny,
right?
But you kind of started out as a theater guy, right? Weren't you a theater guy? Like, you were like in the arts, or you just had an awareness of your art, the arts? Your mom exposed you to it?
Yeah. Well, my mom was like a theater person. She's always like kind of surrounded me by it, but you know, she had to raise my brother and I, so it kind of took a back seat.
Older or younger brother?
Older.
Okay.
He was older.
How many years?
9 years.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So we were kind of like raised as two single children.
Gotcha.
I got, you know, the closest I had to, just in terms of like where I was like someone my age at least, was my cousin, but I didn't see him that much when I was a kid. But, I did improv at UCB first.
How was that?
For like a year and a half, 2 years.
What level did you get to? I did level one.
I did through four.
Okay.
I really enjoyed it. I was like super obsessed with it. Mm-hmm. and I had like a pretty decent job coming out of a AmeriCorps program that I did when I stopped out of school, and I was going to school and I was taking improv classes, and I mm-hmm. like finished them around the same time, 401, and got my associate's degree. So I paid for 101 myself, and then I wrote an essay scholarship for diversity mm-hmm. to get classes for free from 201 through 401. And then I met stand-ups at a stand-ups meet improvisers like meetup thing.
Okay.
And they were like, yeah, you should do mics. And they were like, hey, well, I want to do improv. That's how I met Drew Dowdy and Neruda Williams. And
yeah,
they took me to my first open mic.
Okay.
And then I just...
How long ago was that?
I was like, whew. Did my first open mic like 5 years ago.
Okay.
Last Monday.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. I try not to remember that, but...
You try not to remember when you...
Yeah.
I think for me, it was like late June 2009. Mm-hmm. It was like almost nine years ago.
Mm-hmm.
You try to forget it, like you wish that you never started, or...
No, I just... I can't get out of my head what the first time I got up and I did stand up.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just so funny to me. I don't know. My thing is, sometimes, you know, people ask me how long I've been doing something or something like that. Or just when I think of time, I just feel like my sense of time is skewed because I live in New York. And no one could understand the amount of years I've actually put on my mind and body that actually are undermined by a chronological sense of time.
I get it. Yeah.
Because it's even when people, I think when people especially ask, you know, how long you've worked at something or how long you've been doing something. Like if you ask my mother, you know, how long she's been an actress, she would tell you that she's a reincarnated version of something.
Gotcha.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
Or, I've been acting my whole life. You know what I mean? It's right. That kind of thing. It's a very theatrical kind of...
Sure.
Dramatic...
Yeah.
Kind sense of time. I think it has less delusion... Then I've been doing it for X amount of years only because there's a lot of little things
that
go into making you an artist and go into, you know, your own understanding of, you know, who you are that, you know, kind of sculpted the moment to you getting on stage.
Oh, yeah,
you know what I mean?
I totally understand where you're coming from because it's not like because you've been doing it this amount of years, it means you are this good. I think about that where it's just like, oh God, that was, I was on the phone with my parents on the way here and we're talking about TVs and hooking up a DVD player and all that. And I was thinking
because they want to see Black Panther. Black Panther is saving Blu-ray industry.
I'm getting, I pre-ordered mine, picking it up from Best Buy.
Duh.
One woman on Twitter was like, yeah, Target's being shady with their pre-orders or in-store pickup. I was like, go to Best Buy. No loyalty. They helped me out. So so just do what you got to do. I'm a collector, so I'm definitely excited. My thing is, like, you worry about, is that shit going to be gone once you get there? So I just had to secure my special edition. But
secure the DVD back.
Yeah, yeah. I was... Yeah, we were talking, and I said, yeah, that DVD player, I said, make sure you get an HDMI for your Blu-ray thing, and I was like, yeah, that old DVD player was from 1999, and I was like, fuck, I'm old.
Damn.
That was the first DVD player that I bought.
99.
Yeah, I was 19 back then. I was 19, yeah.
Damn.
So, yeah, I'm old, dude. And I was just
old as hell.
Old as hell, 38. Yeah.
And that's not old.
And I was just like, fuck.
It's middle age for Black men for sure.
and you just wonder where the time went. Please. So it's just like, God, it doesn't even seem that long ago.
Right.
Yeah, so that's why I just I just asked, but yeah, it's not. But you're a funny dude, you know. I would say you would be like, you're on the level of, you're just a real, like a really funny guy, like looking at, because we've done shows together. I was like, oh yeah, Jordan's funny. And then, you know, when I asked you to do the show and I just started to, you know, do the YouTube search, like I really like, I'm not gonna burn your joke. It's on YouTube, but you're but you're
like Steve, subscribe.
You're Steve Urkel Family Matters joke, uh-huh. Where it was just like, yeah, that's pretty, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Like, if Steve Urkel's probably, he could be, like,
yeah,
on the spectrum.
For sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And your other shit's funny, too, but that's just the one that, like, stood out for me.
I try to make them memorable. It's so easy to forget. Stand-up especially. Like, I feel like stand-up is just, it's just, any day now, it's gonna go. I don't know. I mean, when you have one of the best comedians in the country, like John Mulaney, get on a nationally televised platform like SNL, and he delivers that brilliant joke. He was like, being, was it a magician? Or, I don't know. Yeah, he was talking about being a magician during the Civil War or something. He had that bit.
Okay.
He was just like, being, I might be botching the whole shit, but the punchline was something like, well, I'm botching the first part, but the second part is clear. He's like, being a magician during the Civil War is like being a stand-up comedian now.
Yeah.
So he compared it to being a stand-up comedian now.
Yeah.
And he was currently
doing
stand-up. So yeah, that's how you know the game is fucked up, because because it really does feel antiquated. Like, I try to keep it, like, fresh, but, like, as a whole, I don't know. I'm just looking at, like, Netflix, and I'm looking at all these other, you know, platforms. I'm just kind of waiting for the bubble to completely burst. I don't know. I don't know what it is.
You got to have more skills in your quiver, more weapons.
Absolutely. Yeah. No question. That's why, you know, I'm glad that I wrote that play. I had that idea. I wrote The Color Urkel, you know, trying to get into some more acting. That's why I wrote those in the first place, because I wanted to do more acting.
Yeah.
And, you know, I write, so, you know, I'm trying to get a new writing job now, so that's what it is, man. Still do stand-up. I love doing stand-up. Just not now.
Dude, I love it so much that it's just hard to, like, it's just shit that you would do for free, but sometimes it's just like, I can't see myself going all the way out to Brooklyn to do 7 minutes and not get paid for it. And
that's
not
what I'm about to do tonight. So.
Because you love the shakes. Because you love it.
Yeah. I don't also like going back and forth, like having, you know, I'm like thinking about like the thing I'm best at, like what's my driver, like, I heard Hasan Minhaj talk about that, like what's your driver, the best thing you are at comedically. For me, it is stand-up, it happens to be stand-up. And like, then like acting and writing are close second and third, even though I'm like, I think I'm a really good stand-up. I'm also good at those things too. So I think it's whatever, wherever you are, I feel like in terms of what bores me least, what excites me, what experiences I can kind of pour into each part of me that I like to do.
Yeah.
Like, kind of prioritizes itself based on those criterion.
Like, yeah.
Like, it might be acting one day is one for me.
Right.
That I like the most.
It changes.
Then writing, then whatever.
I feel the same way. It's like being on set for something. Like, I worked a lot last year, and it's like, I got my SAG card and stuff, and I moved here to pursue acting, but, and it's like, and then that didn't happen as quickly as I thought.
Right.
And then I threw myself into stand-up because I started when I was 29, and I just sort of, because I had suppressed that desire for so long, and I said, well, New York is the perfect place to do it, and New York as brutal as it is, like I've said this for years, where it's like it can shape you into the artist that you are meant to be. Right. You know, like I try to be a little positive and shit, but it can't. It's New York is fucking hard.
Yeah, it's brutal.
But it's like it can also shape you in that way and mm-hmm. make you battle tested to where when you're in those rooms, when you're in that room at Smilf, you still have the wherewithal to get through and do your job and not right. shit on yourself.
No question.
And then you'll be all the more, you'll be all the better for it. So, oh, you wrote for Smilf. You're like, yeah, motherfucker, give me this other job.
Right.
But like,
I wish it was that easy.
But you know what I mean.
Currently employed. Unemployed, but yeah.
But you can't, you will get another job.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's like, when I was thinking like, being on set, acting and stuff, it's like, oh, fuck, I really do love this.
Right.
I forgot. You know what
yeah,
I mean?
It's like, yeah, no question.
Because my dad, who's always been supportive, he's like, yeah, I bet you think it's not everything you thought it would be. I was like, no, it's better. And I'm just saying like two or three lines, but it's just
that's
like,
awesome.
Like, this is the shit.
Right.
So
it's nice to go back and remember that.
Yeah, yeah.
For sure.
It's hard to forget. Like, what do you think about like all this Donald Glover shit? Like, I think I've talked about him, like, on the episode that's currently up, I talked about him. But it seems like when you're like a polymath like he is, and like you are, you can do different things. Do you think people don't take you as seriously as other people who are just, like, maybe good at one thing or halfway decent at one craft? Is it hard for people to take you seriously?
I don't know. I think people take me seriously. I just think it's a little more isolating in terms of
that's a good way.
Like having no feeling like you kind of have no home a little bit. Like,
yeah.
Like, I'm a little bit, like, I totally have, like, a bunch of, like, stand-up friends and, you know,
sure.
consider myself a stand-up and, you know, I can hit people up within a couple days' notice, get on shows in L.A., like, no problem. But then there's also definitely that feeling like I'm sitting, like, I'm probably never going to get past at the Cellar, even though I think I should.
You don't know that.
But, you know, I feel like...
Dude, how old are you?
29.
Yeah.
But I feel like I sit right outside of a lot of things that I care about now about being accepted in, that when I do get the opportunity to change that gear and get that small acting gig or, you know, get an opportunity to have like a movie idea I have funded or, you know, have a new idea for a play, stage, to get that new writing job or sell that TV show, that I'll care less about whatever thing I thought was important to me at
definitely.
This moment.
Yeah.
And I think that's the most important for me, at least intellectually. I understand that, and also for me in terms of like where I'm going, to always remember that whatever I care about now, I'm going to care less about in the future, and I have to, in all of my pursuit of the things that I want, to be futuristic in every endeavor that I pursue and to stay ahead of the curve in that aspect, because I can get caught up right now, and I do, and I try to avoid it.
You're human.
In the internet and yeah. where people are progressing, whereas, you know, I'm like, well, if I put my energy towards one thing, I could have or da-da, you know, but it's not realistic to who I am as a person, because I've always in my life before comedy have had to be a virtuoso of sorts in, you know, how I temper my emotions, because my home environment, like my mother always, and also like dealing with, you know, contradictions, like my home environment was very peaceful. My mother, you know, raised my brother and I, single mom. She always had books in the house. And I go outside and I'm in the projects. I'm a lot more vulnerable and it's a lot more dangerous. And I went to 5 high schools also where I had to jump from school to school. I always had to be the new guy. Always had to find something, a part of me where I could express to other people so I could like get some damn friends. You know, I always had to be virtualistic in my own life. And I think that's one of the reasons why I apply that to my art. And that's one of the reasons why, you know, I know myself a little better because I've had to self-isolate myself and I've also been isolated and I've dealt with a lot of difficulties and had very singular experiences that I think make me, you know, a better person, a more well-rounded artist in its totality. I want to be well-rounded because of my own experiences outside of comedy.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I always try to push for that.
Why 5 high schools?
The first one, I got expelled. It was a Shaker high school, Shaker campus. Like, Shakers, they, like, shake when they felt like the Holy Ghost or whatever.
Okay.
And they built a lot of things from scratch. It was, like, quote-unquote, holy land.
This is in New York?
Yeah, upstate New York.
Okay.
Darrow School, I got kicked out. I smoked a cigarette. They were afraid that it would burn down. Someone smelled it. I put it in the toilet right after, but nonetheless, got expelled. Went to Union Township where my father and stepmom lived.
Okay.
Next, they got divorced after one semester I had in high school. Came back home, lived with my mom, went to a parochial school. That didn't work. I didn't really have the discipline. I was pretty much unchecked. Then went to the zone school, 2 blocks from where I live. That didn't work. Too close to home.
Mm-hmm.
5th high school, secondhand chance high school. 1 week of work, 1 week of school, had some money in my pocket, figured it out. Then, yeah, just tried not to die, pretty much.
Didn't you go to a boarding school, too?
That was my first school.
Oh, that was the first, okay.
That was the first one, yeah.
Gotcha.
So, yeah, still dumb.
It doesn't seem like you're dumb, man.
Nah.
I know what you're playfully making fun of yourself.
Yeah.
What do you think about, like, with situations like, because I saw on I think it was Alex English's Facebook.
For sure.
I forget what he said.
Shout out to Alex.
Shout out to Alex. What did he say in that post that got?
Would he be if he was famous, would black women care if he was with a white woman? Something to that effect.
Mm-hmm.
If he wasn't. Like, that whole argument, that whole thread got me pretty upset. Understood what some people were saying towards it.
Yeah.
My piece, which I said, and I think, you know, for the record, in terms of interracial dating, I think the thing that gets lost is that it's hard to find love in the first place.
Yes.
And I think that's what people are actually mad about.
Yeah, it's so fucking hard.
People are like, you found love? And it don't look like your mom? Well,
fuck you.
I hate you. Or, nah, it's not exactly that.
Yeah.
I'm just pitching. But I think it's like a lot of people, I think, you know, at the center of this, there are a lot of people wrong. But when it comes to interracial dating it, and you know the opinions black men have on how they are perceived by black women and how they kind of like talk down to black women is completely undeserved. I think it's a small but resounding and loud group of brothers. Mm-hmm. And you know, small but sizable amount of brothers who actually have this terrible poisonous thinking, and there are also a good amount of black women who are not only hurt by that, but then there are those who think that without any provocation think that there are black men that hate them even though they have not, you know, said as such, that you know it's because of you know they hate me or they hate black women in general, or they have some problem wrong with their mom, or they don't date black women. But it's kind of a way to make blanket statements to hide our pain, because
yeah.
a lot of people, I think, and I think the biggest problem when there are some people who completely unwarranted will make comments on interracial couples is, you know, they, some of them will do it in the spirit of pro-blackness, but my thing is, and because I love black people being black and growing up in a very Afrocentric environment by a very proud black single mother, is that you cannot be pro-black if you are anti-gay, because gay people are also black, which also people like to forget, mind you. That is a huge issue. And black people are also women. Black people are also date interracially. So it's like, how can you say you're pro-black when you're anti all the things that black people come in? Black people are trans, black people are women, black people are gay, and black people are not a monolith, you know? And if you say you're pro-black but anti these things, then you're actually not pro-black. And that's my biggest point. And it's so weird that some people would say that it is because, oh, I'm a nerd. Some brothers would be like, oh, I was a nerd and all this.
Yeah, that's fucking ridiculous.
And I'm like, I think that's just an excuse to be like,
to be hateful.
It's definitely an excuse to be hateful. And also, it puts the responsibility on black women to like you because, you know,
you're fucking goofy.
Because you're a goofy ass bastard. You know what I mean?
Dude, I was in the drama club.
It's like, not.
Every black woman that I dated, I outkicked my coverage.
Yeah.
And so it's like, it's just like. And yeah. they were mostly black women. I never felt like.
There's a very small population of black men.
Yeah.
I feel like some people will overstate how many black men will say, oh, I was a nerd and that's why black women didn't like me. The voices are so strong, and they're like small but mighty. I feel like a lot of people who are detractors in any unpopular opinion, especially.
Yeah.
And I think especially in Trumpian times, when there are like the wrong kinds of alternative voices, they are seemingly magnified because their ideas come with the notion of, this is the first time anyone's ever said this. It was like, who said it? People said dumb shit like this in the past.
Yeah.
You just haven't given it any real coverage because we knew it was stupid. Mm-hmm. But now stupid people are seemingly the ones that are on top. So now people are more upset and saying that so many black men think this, or so many of these people think this way. It's still a small percentage of people, but their voices are magnified because so many stupid fucking people are given a voice nowadays. These are the same niggas that say black women didn't like me in high school because I was a nerd are the same niggas that are on Fox and are friends with fucking Ben Carson and stupid niggas.
Even like, he's married to a black woman.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I'm saying, right? Yeah.
He found somebody.
Right. Ben Carson can't find a black woman, then there's no hope. It ain't because you're a nerd, nigga. It's because nobody likes you.
Yeah, it's...
You know? It ain't even about... Some people just love the wrong people.
Mm-hmm.
To be honest, some people find love and it's completely wrong in the case of Ben Carson and his wife. You know what I'm saying?
It's just like, because we started out talking about how brutal New York City is.
Right.
And you fucking find somebody that connects, that you connect with and makes you feel like less of a shitty person.
Right.
So that there's some hope and it's like, fuck, well, why not embrace that? Right. And it's hard. Like,
it's super hard.
And then you just like, and then we'll wrap it up in a bit. And we'll just, it's hard because like when I get relationships in for me, it's just like, oh, I guess I'm going to throw myself into my career and just like keep going in and just like continue to focus on that. And that's unhealthy.
Yeah, it is.
That's not fucking right. Like, that's not good either. So,
Right.
You have to figure that shit out. And that's what I'm in the process of, but I would not like deny myself somebody if I felt the connection with them just because they weren't black.
Right. I just started dating white women within the last 5 to 7 years of my life.
Mm-hmm.
Because I started doing comedy.
That's who you were around.
And that's who I was. But before that, I was dating all black and Latina women.
Because you're in New York.
Also, yeah. A black Latina woman.
Yeah.
People forget Latino people.
Coming up in theater, when it was definitely, there were black women that I liked that I went out with. Yeah. There were a couple of white girls. And I'm thinking, like, comedy, there were black women that I liked that didn't want to date me. So but I was never like,
that's
that's just life.
That's just life.
And I wasn't like, well, fuck all you black women. I was just like,
right.
You're hot. You're not into me.
Right.
I'll be with somebody in the tent. Like Dion Cole said in his Netflix special, the bit was basically like, I date whoever will date me. He's like, he'll go up to women in a club and a bunch of women. He's like, which one of y'all like me?
Yeah.
It's like shit like that, man. Right. Like, it's just, yeah, I just don't like to see all that hate. So, and then if you're a black artist and you achieve something and you do something that's cool that most mainstream America likes, then it's like, okay, well, what can we, like, not like you for? Oh, your girlfriend's white. This Donald Glover
she's
shit.
She's white. Is his significant other, his baby mom's or whatever, is white and Asian.
Okay.
But, like, I don't even know that, like, shouldn't even matter.
It shouldn't.
Like, I mean, less than that, it's kind of weird that just in the time where where black people have celebrated Obama, considering he's done less for us than we hold him up to as, and we also celebrate him for, you know, being such an exceptional, beautiful, lovely black woman. I think we also forget that the reason why he's our president in the first place is because he had a white mother. The bottom line is, Obama was brilliant, but if both of his parents were black, he would not be the president, period. The only reason why we had a black president is because he was raised white. So if you're upset about interracial relationships, but you love Obama, you need to check yourself. You need to, like, go see somebody about that. You need to think about how, you need to look at a black and white cookie and get mad at it. You know what I'm saying? Like, there's so many other things to, like, really reconcile, I think, within yourself.
Yeah.
Especially if you're black. And I understand there's some hurt, but I don't know why you love this beige nigga who's done nothing. And you know what I'm saying?
That's of Jordan Temple.
The nigga's done nothing for black people. And I think that's the greatest reminder that his mother's white.
I think we're gonna get some letters.
If you black and you wake up and think, why don't Obama do shit for black people? Just make sure you look at a picture of him around his white mother and grandparents, and you just really, you know, think about why he say, you know, goofy shit about niggas. I mean, he's half white, man. He got along and knew how to appease white people because his grandparents gave him cookies growing up. Ain't no white people give me cookies growing up. I didn't think white people was safe until like 3 years ago, my first long-term white girlfriend. And even then, I had to go to Florida to visit her damn family. And I've never felt more unsafe.
What was that like?
It's fine. She doesn't know her dad, so that's cool. I'm her dad. But yeah, you know, this shit is it's fucked up. It's just, it's so many people. I just can't get over that distinction. So many people.
No, it makes me
love Obama, but he ain't interracial. Then okay, cool. Get back to me when he's president the third time.
That's a, you know what I'm saying? I like that premise. I mean, I didn't even think about that. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't understand. But then again, there are some of those same people who can't reconcile both. Who, if you really spoke to them, like, in actuality, don't love Obama as much as they say they do. You know, they flippy floppy.
Well, I think maybe they reconcile him because he's married to a black woman, like you said.
Right.
Probably because he quote unquote shows right, like what's that episode? The Helen episode of Atlanta when her Van's girlfriend.
Oh, like, yeah.
You chose black, and she's like, "What the fuck do you mean?"
Ha.
You right. Know? So if we really want to be progressive, like we say we are, like, I just think it's just so hard to find somebody, and if you find somebody that you connect with, it's not like. But at the same time, I think with a black woman, you think that there might be a shorthand, like culturally. But other than that, a woman's a woman.
Not if y'all don't get along.
Well, yeah, definitely.
If you don't so get along, so many people are like. I mean, it goes down to who you love.
Right.
I mean, I remember in Justin Williams' post, it's great. He's like, R. Kelly loves black women. You can argue he loves black women the most, but I mean, he's hurting them the most. Does it matter that he loves black women and he's with, you know what I mean?
I texted him after, like, I liked the post.
It's crazy.
And I texted
him.
I was like, yo, that's a great post. And he's like, yeah, but a lot of people aren't going to respond to it.
Yeah. You know. We need to, I think it's less about, you know, who you think is, like, giving or, like, being, you know, being, like, sticking to their race is less about that and more like who is actually respecting black women. I can't.
Yeah.
You know, I respect black women even though I'm not currently having sex with them. I think that's, like, common and, like, that goes without saying. Like, I love black women, period.
It's like Chris Rock used to say, my mother's a black woman. What did he say? He said, I love black women. My mother's a black woman. I think it was like big ass jokes or whatever. It doesn't matter. But yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Jordan, this has been good.
Christopher.
This has been good, man. Where can people find you on social media? I'll put it in the show notes, but.
Cool. Yeah, I am very lightly on Twitter.
Okay.
At Jordy Ploy.
What does that mean?
Jordy Ploy?
Yeah.
Well, Jordy was my nickname as a kid. My mom,
right?
My mom and my brother called me Jordy, and employ is a trick.
Okay. Means
trick. I put them together. Jordy Ploy. I'm full of tricks.
Gotcha.
I'm tricky as hell. I'm mischievous. I love to trick people. Jokes are tricks.
Gotcha.
You know, I'm just a magician without a top hat. You know what I'm saying?
I like that.
No rabbit though.
Yeah.
All about that ruckus. No uncle.
Gotcha. And Hidden Fences is going to be in L.A. soon, right?
Hell yeah. Doing Hidden Fences in L.A. June 7th and 8th at the Hayward Theater at Dynasty Typewriter. 2511 Wilshire Boulevard.
All right. Jordan, this has been great, man. Been Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me. Monday Comedy Festival.
That's right.
With Christopher.
You just say Chris.
It's
fine.
Christopher Lambert.
All right. All right, y'all take it easy, everybody.
Later, niggas.